Welcome to Strong Tower Radio Today. The views and opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect the views of Strong Tower Radio, West Central Michigan Media Ministries, or its employees.
Hi folks, I'm Jalene Fenner with Strong Tower Radio Today with my co-host
Tom Majeure.
And it's the month of June, and we are talking about Tom's favorite Strong Tower Radio program.
The Good with, Growing with the Garden, Guy and Gal.
Yeah, well now, and so, yeah, our Good Gardening with the Garden Guy has been Gary Hiley. And now we have Gary's wife, Jesusa. So it's the gardening couple, right, Tom? Is
that's
that what
right.
We decided?
And she's also the gardening nurse. So.
Oh, yes, yes. By profession, she is a nurse. And so welcome you two.
Thank
I'm
you.
Happy to be here.
Happy to be here. Yes.
And we're going to talk more about what Gary and Jesusa will be doing and adding, because he has a YouTube channel.
Mm-hmm.
And you just type in your name, Gary, and it's Heilig,
H-E-I-L-I-G.
I-G.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going to learn a lot. You go on that YouTube.
And these guys are a gardening team. It's
yes.
They've been doing this for years. They've been doing it for 44 years together, and they've known themselves since kindergarten. So this is a truly bonded couple, and this is a something they do together.
I've been enjoying when we talk off air about how they're gardening and cooking and preserving. So this is just wonderful.
Amen.
Well, Tom, why don't you have a word of prayer for us?
Will do. Our great Heavenly Father, thank you so much that you gave us a part in creation.
Amen.
Husbandry and maintenance. And it brings such joy. It brings health. It brings produce. And it brings great attitude. Just be with us. And as we study gardening this month, in Jesus' name, amen.
Well, amen. Last month, Gary, we ran out of time. I had asked about moles because those little pests leave dirt piles all over your yard.
Is she overreacting here or something?
It depends on how you feel about moles.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and how you feel about having a perfect lawn.
Yes, that's right. It's nice. And lawns look nice when they're perfect. They look nice. But let's just talk about moles. If you want to get rid of them, what can you do and what doesn't work?
Well, the most effective and probably the most economical way to get rid of them is using traps. And the easiest trap to use would be the harpoon trap.
So that's
that sounds deadly.
It is for the mole.
I think it's misnamed a trap. It should be called the
guillotine.
Mole. Yeah, the mole skewer.
And basically, when you set a mole trap to be successful, you have to know which runs are still active. And those are the ones that usually are fairly straight. There are other runs that go in all directions, no apparent direction. Those are just feeding burrows, and they only use those once. So if you're not sure if this is one of the areas that you want to put a trap on, just push that area down, and within a few hours, it should be up again.
Then that's an active
run. So what you need to do is set your trap, and you want to be sure that the supports of the trap are not where the run is going to be.
Blocking it.
That's right. You're going to push that section down where you want to put the trap because you want the mole to go through and repair it. And then those two support structures should be on either side of where he's going to repair it. Otherwise, he'll go around the trap. And there's a plate that you set on there like you do, sort of like a mouse trap.
Mm-hmm.
And when he pushes up on that plate, it sends these skewers down. Now, if you have a heavier textured soil, you need to prime the trap, which means you actually push the prongs down into the hole.
Creating a pathway.
That's right. And then what you need to do after that, once you set the trap, is put a little bit of soil in those holes that you put in the ground, because light will cause them to go around that area too. Another thing that you can do is put like a 5-gallon bucket that you pick up from Home Depot or Lowe's or someplace over top of the trap. That does two things. One, make sure that light doesn't get into the area. And two, make sure you don't run over the trap with your mower.
Okay.
Which I have done.
Experience.
So, yeah. And if you haven't caught anything within a couple of days, move the trap. Don't let it sit there for a week or 2 weeks. It should be catching the mole within a day or two.
Okay.
And you also have to realize that your yard is not full of moles. They're very territorial, so you may only have one or two there. One could be at one level in the soil, and another could be down a little deeper. But rarely do you have more than that unless you have a lot of property.
Well, but they have babies.
They do have babies, but the babies are run off. They have to find their own spot. Now, you're more likely to have moles also if you happen to live near an open field or a forest, so they will migrate in. And once you get rid of moles in your yard by trapping, you can put a castor oil barrier, about a 5-foot barrier wide around your property perimeter, and that will cause them not to come back into the yard.
You use castor oil.
It's the castor oil, but it's not just any castor oil. It has to be the old type of castor oil, and there are some products that you can use, either granulars or liquids. And even that has to be applied in the proper way. You have to get about a 1/2 inch of rain, put the material down, and you need another 1/2 inch of rain after that.
Is this something you get at a garden store? Or
yeah, you can find it at some of the better garden stores. They do have it at places like Home Depot and Lowe's.
So do you apply it while it's raining, or do you
you could put
fake
it down.
Rain, use a hose and wet it down, and then...
Yeah, you could either wet it down if you have the ability to do that, or you can apply it right during a rain. As long as you get a good rain, you want to get it out there, because it has to be pushed down into the area where they are.
That's why the water pushes it into the ground.
The other thing that you'll find when you use castor oil, you may actually experience additional damage if you were using it just in general in your yard, because they don't like it. But then when they're driven out of the area, they will stay out for up to about 5 weeks, depending on what kind of soil you have. It tends to last longer on heavier textured soils than on light textured. Now, there are all kinds of other things out there that people do. For instance, you may have heard of juicy fruit gum. The idea behind that was they would eat it, it would clog up their digestive system, and they would die. No, it doesn't work. Okay. We do not suggest pouring gasoline down there or putting broken glass down there.
Ooh.
Those don't work.
Gasoline pollutes the soil.
Yeah, well, that's not legal to do anyway, but people do it. There is also...
People get desperate, you know.
Yeah, there are baits, and some baits work and some don't. Like the treated grain baits that have zinc phosphide, it would kill them if they ate it, but they won't eat it. So how good is that?
Yeah.
Now, there is a product called Mole Patrol. It looks sort of like a cat food, and that can be put down in the holes. Or you can use these little, they look like gummy worms, and they have a product in it called bromethalin, and that works also. Now, the bromethalin worms are expensive. They're about $1 a piece, but it will kill them. And when you're applying those materials, use gloves. You basically punch a hole in the runs, pour some in, and then close the run up carefully, and that will kill them.
Well, it's just, I mean, moles are, they're kind of like mice, just a pest. You don't want them.
Yeah, you could, I mean, the grass will grow back. They're not much damage to the turf. They can be a bit of a problem in a vegetable garden in that they usually will go right down a row after you've just planted something. And that's usually because you've watered that row and earthworms are attracted into that area. And the primary food source for moles is earthworms. They will eat grubs, but you can have a lawn that has no grubs, and you can still have moles if you have
because you have earthworms.
Yeah.
Now, I got a question at the previous station that we had on Tracy Lane off of Boone Road in Cadillac. There would be these mounds that would be 4 inches, 5 inches high. Mm-hmm. It was cone-shaped. Is that a mole, or is that something else?
Most likely a mole. There are two species of moles in Michigan. One is the eastern mole, and the other is the star-nosed mole. The star-nosed mole you hardly ever see unless you're near wet areas, and they tend to make their really high areas or cone piles. But the other, the eastern moles, can do it too, because when they're excavating, they have to put that soil somewhere. So occasionally, especially when they're making a den for reproduction, they will push big piles up. Or after they've gone a certain distance, they will push soil up on the surface. So it could be either one of them, but most likely it's the eastern mole.
Okay.
All right. Well, let's transition. In June, lots of times we start harvesting strawberries.
Mm-hmm.
Is there do's and don'ts in harvesting strawberries?
Well, nothing critical except that if you want them to last longer, you want to pick them early in the morning before they've gotten warm, because when fruits get field heat in them as a result of being heated up by the sun, it really shortens their life. And strawberries are very perishable. They're usually only good for a couple of days, especially if you don't spray them with fungicides. And they can break down very quickly. So you want to get out there and get them really early.
What does field heat look like in a strawberry? Does it just look mushy?
No, it's just warm. It's from the result of the sun on it, and the strawberry is warm as opposed to like it's cool in the morning.
It just doesn't have good shelf life.
It has a very short shelf life, especially if you don't spray them for funguses. They'll last a day, and the next day you'll see funguses growing on them.
So is this the same thing for blueberries and raspberries? You should always get them
raspberries
in the morning?
Yes. Blueberries are a lot more tolerant. Okay. You can pick those during the heat of the day, and you can set them on the cabinet, and they'll still be fine 2-3 days later.
But they don't come, they're not ready in June. Strawberries are usually always ready.
Yeah,
at least here in the Cadillac area, near the end of June.
For us, in the Lansing area, it's about the second week of June. Up here, it's going to be back a couple of days, maybe another week or so. Mm-hmm. And normally by... we're done by about the 4th of July on strawberries, unless you have what we call day neutrals or everberries. The day neutrals will crop every 6 weeks, you have to keep picking them. But if you're going to grow those, you're going to have to spray them for what we call the spotted wing Drosophila, which Drosophila is a fancy word for fruit fly. But this particular fruit fly is different from your regular fruit flies that are just attracted to things that are breaking down and fermenting. This one, the female has a saw-like ovipositor, which is a structure that allows her to deposit her eggs in the fruit. And they actually put it inside the skin of all the soft fruit, like strawberries, raspberries, blackberries, blueberries. And if you don't spray for that, you can get away with not spraying the early strawberries, but the ones that are later, the fruit fly numbers build up to the point to where you'll have worms in them.
So... and this is a fairly new fruit fly when we were talking off air.
Yeah, it was found in Michigan in 2011.
Okay, so how do you know if your strawberries, they're growing, they have these fruit flies?
Well, you cut the strawberries open, and I pretty much guarantee that later season strawberries will have them, because I did a little experiment. I was growing some on my deck, and I didn't spray them, and most of them had maggots in them. So there is a trap that you can make that you can monitor to see when they're around. And on my YouTube channel, I tell you how to make that trap.
All right.
And I also have a video on that particular pest problem and how to treat it. If you want to use organic products, I would use either spinosad or neem, N-E-E-M. And spinosad is S-P-I-N-O-S-A-D. And those are the two organic products, but conventional products, malathion, will work just fine for it.
So this is why you need to spray your strawberries.
Once you get past June, yes. The early strawberries, the numbers are low enough to where you can get by without spraying, and you're not likely to have very many there, if any. But later in the season when it's warm, their numbers explode.
So now when do you thin out your strawberries?
Well, you're talking more about something called renovation, which we normally don't do until the end of the strawberry season. And when the strawberries are finished producing, you can thin the rows down to about 6 inches. And it depends on your system. Like, for instance, with me, I grow my strawberries in a black landscape fabric, and I don't have to renovate them because they're individual plants. And so I'll run them for about 4 or 5 years and then tear the whole bed out. But if you have a bed in what's called a matted row system, it will continue to get wider and wider if you don't renovate. So usually in around July, you will till the rows back to about 6 inches wide. And if you have some really old strawberries in there, which have very long crowns, you may thin some of those out. The ideal spacing for strawberries for production is every 6 inches.
Now, I have a question. You've used the word renovate, which I think you did define, but let's say it again. When you say renovate, is that the thinning out?
What you're doing is you're renewing your bed so that those remaining mother plants will produce runners and start new baby plants. Those are going to be more productive. Okay. After about 4 or 5 years, even if you really manage your strawberries well, they will start to peter out unless you renovate that bed yearly.
And okay. I just want to say that when you do grow the strawberries on the black plastic, they're a lot cleaner, so they're not in the dirt. When it rains, they don't get splashed upon. So you can actually pick them and eat them right in the garden, which is what we do.
No crunchies.
No crunchies.
That's what she does. I always suggest that you wash off anything, especially if you've used any kind of pesticides in the garden.
That's true. Okay, now you said something about matted rows?
Yeah, there are different systems for growing strawberries. A matted row is where you start out planting your strawberries in the beginning 24 inches apart, and then you let the runners fill in the row. And a matted row is usually a solid planting of strawberries about 2 feet wide. Then you can do something called a ribbon system, which is a series of rows where the strawberries are planted about 6 inches apart. And they call that a rhythm system or a spaced row system when you're using a black plastic or landscape fabric. I prefer to use the landscape fabric because you pretty much eliminate all weeding. And I don't know if you know this or not, but weeding is the number one thing that we do in the garden in terms of time consumption.
Right.
And when you have a landscape fabric, you don't have that problem. And then you just simply cut off any runners until you want to start a whole new bed.
Is there different types of matting or fabric that you use? There's fabric that you put underneath mulch to keep weeds down. Is there different grades?
Yeah, I like to use the one that's a 10-year life. A lot of the mulches that you use now they can be good for about a year if they're exposed to the sunlight and then they're done. But this is a very dark one, and it's a thick one. So it's a plastic material.
What is June drop?
People would call sometimes, especially with their cherry trees, and they said, all the fruit's falling out.
That's June drop?
That's June drop. It happens on all fruits, and it's a way that the tree tends to balance how much fruit is on it. It'll tend to abort things that are damaged by disease or insects, and around June is when you start to see all that happening. That doesn't mean that you won't have to do some additional thinning on certain things like apples and peaches and pears, but you don't have to worry about cherries.
So that's just kind of a natural thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And these fruits, then, it's not that you're not going to eat them.
No, it's kind of like the tree self-thinning, but you may have to do some additional thinning on some of the fruits in certain years.
It's hard for me to do thinning on fruits. I'm thinking I'm wasting fruit.
No, you only need to actually set about 7% of the flowers to have a full crop. Remember, those little fruits become very large.
And you can compost them. So that's what I do. I put them all in the big bucket.
So it's not wasted.
And then I just take them and put them in the compost pile. And I said, you know, God giveth and God taketh away. Okay. So.
But we use that compost in the garden for something else. So.
Okay. All right. Well, folks, we got to take a quick break, but stay tuned. We'll be right back. More about gardening.
Hey, Martha, do you know what's easier than falling off a horse?
Falling off a log?
Oh, okay then, but do you know what's less painful than falling off a horse?
Not falling off a horse?
No, I mean, yeah, well, yes, but I'm just trying to tell the people how easy and painless it is to support Strong Tower Radio.
Well, you sure are taking a long way around to get there. Friend, if you want to help lead others to Jesus, if you desire to help others find their way to the kingdom of God, prayerfully consider becoming a covenant partner with Strong Tower Radio.
To do that, you may call us at 231-468-2087 or go to our secure website, that's www.strongtowerradio.org, and click on that donate button.
There you will find all the information you need to become a covenant partner.
Thank you for listening to, praying for, and supporting Strong Tower Radio,
where God's character is proclaimed.
Hi, folks. Welcome back to Strong Tower Radio today. And Tom, we have been talking with our garden guy.
And garden wife.
I was going to say yes. And he brought along his wife because he always talks about, you know, we and, you know, what we do. And so we are glad that Jesusa is with us as well as Gary.
Hello.
And we were talking about harvesting strawberries and, you know,
fruit drop.
Yeah, fruit drop and everything. So let me ask you, is it too late, we're in the month of June, to plant trees and shrubs?
That depends. If you're buying something from the garden center that's container grown, no, it's not too late. If you wanted to move something in your yard from one place to another, like you wanted to transplant, you're going to stress that plant more because you're going into the warmer weather.
Why is that stressing more out of your own yard than from a container?
Because you're not going to get all the roots.
Okay. They've now contained the roots in there.
Right. All the roots are contained in the container. And a container grown plant is one that's been in that container for at least a year. If you're going to take something in your yard, there are a couple of things you could do. One, have a larger root ball so that you get as many of the roots as you can, but that makes it heavier. But if you were to water it before you dug it out and balled and burlapped it with a large ball, then you can move it and then get it back in the ground.
And the burlap is to keep that soil together. Otherwise, it'll drop out as you're carrying it across the yard.
And you lose a lot of those very fine roots, which are the roots, are the ones that pick up most of the water nutrients.
So when is it too late to plant trees and shrubs?
When you start getting into the hottest part of the year, like July, for instance, I would probably not do much transplanting or planting at that time. You want to try to put things in the early spring, which we're talking about April, May, early June, and then in the fall, September, October. And once things are dormant, you can still plant in November.
Okay. Now, one year, I was on 4th of July, I went by the Walmart garden center and they were having clearance. I mean, a dollar a plant and whatever. If you're getting a really great bargain, you can lose a few plants. I took those, I healed them into the ground and it was a great, it filled out my yard, really.
Right. But if those were container grown plants and they've taken care of those containers, you could get away with it as long as you're good at the follow through. Which means you're getting that plant mulched so it's not losing water very quickly. You're watering on a regular basis. That way you probably could pull it off. And the weather makes a difference too, because when it's cooler, there's less stress on the plant than if you're going through a drought like we did a couple of years ago.
Okay, so what about your flowering shrubs? When do you prune them?
A general rule of thumb is for flowering shrubs, if you have something that flowers in the spring, say like a lilac, you wait, or the forsythia, you wait until after they finish flowering, then you prune. If it's a summer flowering plant or a plant that flowers after June, then you can prune in the spring without worrying about destroying any flower buds, because they form their flower buds during the later months. And now you can still prune things like forsythia and lilacs in the spring if you want, or during the winter months, but you will sacrifice some flowers because those buds are already in place now.
Well, what about very mature lilacs that have been growing? They're almost trees. How do you work with those?
Because nobody's pruned them.
And there are some trees, if you've ever been up to Mackinac Island, they have some huge lilacs. And some of them are probably over 100 years old.
Wow.
And what you do is slowly take out some of the largest ones, which will also reduce the height of the plant. And as you take out some of those larger branches, newer ones will come up.
Can you replant that, what you'd cut off and put in the ground?
No. If you were going to propagate a lilac, you'd have to do something called a softwood cutting. So the new growth, up until around June, you'd take cuttings from that and you use rooting hormone and you could start new plants. But when you're cutting off a section of a lilac for pruning, you're cutting it right down to the ground and that section is going to die. But the response of the plant is to send up new shoots, which will become more productive in terms of they'll have bigger flowers and they'll have them at a lower height.
Does different areas around the state of Michigan are more fertile for lilacs? I've noticed here in the Cadillac area a huge amount of lilacs. I would rename it the Lilac City.
Well, lilacs can grow in a wide variety of soils. The biggest thing is they need to have good drainage. And the fertility of the soil is based on how much clay you have in it, how much sand, how much silt. Sand cannot hold nutrients.
Really?
Clay and silt and organic matter can. So compost and those types of things help to hold nutrients, which the plant can make use of when it needs it.
I'm going to ask a out-of-the-area question. We started a garden for my son the first year down in Georgia, and that's out of our broadcast area, at least currently. But I looked at that soil, and it's so different than our soil.
It's red.
It's red, and it's clay, and I just thought, you cannot grow anything in that. He sent me a picture 3 weeks later, and I'm just blown away at how productive and how fertile that soil is.
Clay soils are very fertile soils because they have what's called a high cation exchange capacity, which means that those negatively charged clay particles can hold on to positively charged nutrients like potassium and phosphorus and those types of things. So they kind of bind together and the plants can get them, whereas in sand, it tends to move right down through the soil over time. Those red soils are red because of the iron content.
Oh, yeah.
And plants need iron too.
Okay, I heard you say compost. So how do you make a good compost pile?
Well, one of the things, a rule in our family is never let organic matter leave the property unless you can help it. So we rake up leaves. We even take food scraps, like when we peel potatoes and apples and things. I have three bins that worms are constantly breaking this material down for me. And then during the summer months, I have a compost tumbler. I have another area for composting. And we allow this to break down. And when compost breaks down, it's like a peat material. And when you add organic matter to your soil, you not only improve its ability to hold and release nutrients, but organic matter also acts like a sponge, and it holds water, so your plants are less likely to be subject to drought. So there's nothing bad about keeping compost.
Now, do you mix dirt in it?
In the process of composting, some soil will get mixed in with it, but I have a turning unit where it's you put the organic matter in it, and you turn it to compost it, so soil, field soil, is not getting mixed in there.
Now, I've got a question, and Jesus, you can jump in here. Why you mentioned three compost containers. Why three?
Because we have a lot of organic matter in our property.
And they're at different stages. So we have a huge tumbler. It's like a huge tumbler. And I told him if he wanted me to put compost in it, he needed to be close to the house because we collect it in the kitchen. I just want to go out and dump it in there and to be done instead of walking all the way out to the garden. So
I can move it to the deck if you want me to.
It's close enough where it is. And it gets a lot of good sun where it is too, so it gets hot in there.
It's hot, so, good?
Yeah. Hut's good.
Yeah, hut's good. I thought I put something in the ground. My grandfather used to have a galvanized pail and went into the ground and we put in it. But it was in the shade, and the one I have is in the sun, and I think I baked all the good stuff in so it doesn't break down, or am I just wet?
Okay, here comes the science.
Uh-oh.
There are three basic groups of bacteria that break down organic matter.
Okay.
The saprophytic bacteria that can work at zero up to about 40 degrees or so. Then we have a mesophilic bacteria that work in the middle.
That doesn't sound good. It sounds like a disease.
No, it's the middle bacteria. Okay. They work up to about 80 to 90 degrees. And then we have the thermophilic bacteria, which really knock a pile down in a hurry. Those guys work at over 100 degrees. And so depending on what the weather's like will determine which bacteria will predominate inside your pile. And there are other conditions that are important, too. The carbon to nitrogen ratio, moisture levels, things of that sort.
But we got smart 1 year, I don't know if it was 3 or 4 years ago. We used to take all of our compost out of the garden, and now we just compost right in the garden. So we say, there's a compost pile going right there, and as we're cleaning up the garden or we have waste or zucchinis that have gotten out of control, we just put them right there in the garden. And so then we just let that break down in the garden, and the next year, Gary moves it out.
And we also do something called pit composting. Since we have so many apple peels, we will make these big pits in the garden. They'll be like 2 feet deep and however long they need to be. And we just pour all that organic matter in there. And this attracts the worms, and the worms feed on all this material, and when they poop it out, it's perfect for plants. And you can see a noticeable difference in the quality of the plants where you've done that versus just your regular garden.
So you just allocate a radius of 2 or 4 feet in the garden. You dig a hole and just dump
your... Yeah, depending, it's more like a trench.
Okay.
Yeah, I mentioned to Tom earlier that our daughter, who's 29 years old, lives with us. She loves to dig, so we'll just send her out there to dig the trenches, and in the early fall.
Yeah, we're both 65.
Yeah, and then she even hauls the buckets out and puts the peels there, and that's where she plants her potatoes every year, and they're wonderful. So
she takes it from that tumbler that's
We fill the as Gary said. A Menard or Home Depot, those big buckets.
5 gallons.
We will fill sometimes 2 and 3 of those in one evening, peeling apples to make applesauce. So
then she carries that out to the garden.
Mm-hmm. She digs the trench and then carries that out to the garden and buries it and digs another trench, and we just keep going right up the garden space.
Sounds like a division of labor here.
It is.
We're going to hate to see Leanne leave. She wants to become a travel nurse, so she might be leaving us this year.
Oh, my.
Okay, so it's June, and we've planted things. Okay, so in leafy greens, they grow quick, so we can harvest.
Mm-hmm. Usually around this time in June, you can harvest your spinach and all different types of greens. Like collard greens, people will grow them really huge, but they're quite tender when they're small. So
they would taste better, wouldn't they, then?
Not necessarily, because as I mentioned earlier in one of the programs, when you get a slight frost, all the cabbage family tastes better, especially collards. But
Is it sugar content or what is it?
Yeah, it's, to a certain extent it's sugar content. But
you know, I never thought of collards as that category of a cold weather crop.
Yeah, you don't know this, but collards, broccoli, cauliflower, kohlrabi, cabbage, they're all the same plant botanically. They've just been modified through breeding.
And you know, I learned that on the Good Gardening show here.
So all those leafy greens can be harvested, and you should always keep a supply of these going, because leafy greens have a lot of good nutrition in them. And maybe we can get into that sometime, but it has what we call phytochemicals.
Yes.
And the cabbage family especially has products in them that will actually fight off cancer and help to prevent it. So it's a good idea to have those always constantly coming out of your garden. But the first ones will come in about that time.
And how long can this go? This is a cold weather crop. How late can that go?
Oh, you can grow them on into the fall. And now you have two options of harvesting. You can just come and cut everything and then reseed. Or you can just harvest some and don't damage the growing points and they'll grow back.
Yeah,
of course, you have to water and fertilize.
I take my kitchen shears out to the raised bed and just pick the... maybe the older ones, leave the more tender ones there, and I just harvest the big ones and bring them in and then go back out in a couple of days and we have another from the same plant. You'll have more production.
Some of the same root stock.
Same roots.
You can do this all summer as long as you water and fertilize.
So, well, let's talk about these vegetables growing without using pesticides.
Yeah, one of the things I used to like to do when I was teaching gardening classes is I showed this cabbage plant that had absolutely no pesticides applied to it, and it was perfect. And, of course, people were real interested in that, because if you plant a cabbage and you leave it alone, the imported cabbage worm, cutworms, diamondback moth, there's a number of different ones that will just tear it up. So what I would do is... when I put the plants in, the first thing I would do is put a collar around it, like an old soup can or something.
Seriously?
Yeah. You could use a styrofoam cup or whatever.
It's for the cutworm.
That keeps the cutworm from cutting off the plant.
So what do you do with this now?
You're putting a collar around the trunk.
How tight?
Oh, it doesn't have to be tight at all. It could be about this big. You could even use just a dowel.
This big is 1 inch, 2 inch?
Oh, I'm sorry.
We're on radio. That's right. He does television interviews, too.
Videos.
Yeah. You know, just like a tomato paste can will work.
Oh, yeah.
Or a soup can or something like that.
I gotcha.
Well, you even said a styrofoam cup. So just the top of the cup?
Cup. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You just cut the bottom out
and put
it around the plant.
Okay.
That keeps the cutworms.
Up or down, upside down? Or
doesn't really matter.
Okay.
It just keeps the cutworm from getting to the plant. Or you could take like a dowel and set it right next to the plant stem, and the cutworm has to wrap himself around it in order to cut the plant, and he won't be able to do that with a dowel next to it.
All right.
Next thing I do is I put down coffee grounds, and they can be used or fresh. They have to have caffeine in them, because if you have slugs, then they'll eat the caffeine, and that will kill them.
So I could go to, not that I drink coffee, but I could go down to the convenience store and
Starbucks. Ask. They'll give you all you want.
Really? Mm-hmm. Okay.
Get their coffee grounds.
And so you put those coffee grounds down. Then we put newspaper down to keep the weeds down and straw on top of that. And then over top of all of that, we use something called a row cover. And it's a lightly spun white material. And we make sure it's loose enough so that if I'm growing cabbage under there, it will, as it gets bigger, it'll expand. And so, nothing can get to it physically.
Really. So this is how you can avoid worms in your...
You can avoid everything doing that. I mean, all you have to really
Everything
do,
is a big word.
Yeah, everything. I mean, rabbits won't go after it.
Really?
They will not go under there. The deer will leave it alone. They won't go under there.
Because using coffee grounds.
No. The coffee grounds is just for... The slugs
that come through the soil.
The covering, the row cover, keeps the butterflies from physically getting to the cabbage or whatever it is.
Yeah, the flying pests.
And it also keeps the deer off. Rain can go through it.
All right. Okay.
And so the only thing you may have to do is fertilize, and the cabbage will just grow perfectly under there.
Now, let me ask you, is this different than cheesecloth?
It's similar, but it's a different material.
It's a tighter weave, and that's where my sewing skills come in, because when we grew broccoli 1 year, and it gets really tall.
Yeah.
So I actually had to sew two lengths of the row cover together to make a big enough drape for the broccoli, but it was the best broccoli we ever had that year. So
never sprayed it.
So getting this resource, do I walk into the box stores, or do I have to go to a garden center? Where do I get it?
Row covers are usually available in garden centers. I don't remember seeing it in Home Depot or Lowe's, but they might have it now.
But of course, you can always go online.
Yeah, you can go online and buy it. You can get different thicknesses, but I would use the lighter thickness.
We were picking those white, yellow bugs off all year, and that's a lot of work.
Nope, don't have to do that.
And it sounds like a big production in the beginning, but once you do it, you get used to doing it, and you just are so grateful that you don't have to be out there spraying Dipel on your cabbage, you know, every time it rains
and
or frequently.
I'm going to ask the question, could I find this on Gary Heilig's YouTube channel?
Not yet. I used to have it on there, but I started redoing the channel after I left the university. So I'm going to put it back up there, though.
Okay. So now this cover, though, can you use it from year to year?
Mm-hmm. Yes, it will last multiple years. Yeah.
Yep. Take care of it. Shake it out. Roll it up. Sometimes I spray it with the hose to get if there's any dirt that's persistent, because you do have to bury it under. You have to what do you call it?
You have to put some soil around it or put something on it so it won't blow up.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. We use bricks too. Okay. We have bricks, pieces of brick, or we use stones or, you know, big rocks, whatever we have.
But it has to be a large enough piece so that whatever your plant is under there, like the cabbage or broccoli, it has a chance to expand. Right. Otherwise, it'll prevent it from growing.
Okay. If it's too tight.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, folks, we got to take a quick break, but stay tuned because we'll be right back with more of our gardening couple.
Yeah, amen.
The Bible and God's character are under attack like never before. Here at Strong Tower Radio, we are proud to hold up the Bible as a lamp unto our feet and a light unto our path. We believe the Bible is the Word of God and contains the good news of God's character and His great plan of salvation for mankind. If you know and believe this to be true, won't you help Strong Tower Radio proclaim the truth about our God and His Word, the Bible? To do that, go to www.strongtowerradio.org, and there, on our secure website, you will find a donate button. Click on that and give as the Lord directs. Thank you for listening and supporting Strong Tower Radio, where God's character is proclaimed.
Hi. Hi, folks. Jelaine Fenner here, and welcome back to Strong Tower Radio today with my co-host,
Tom Majeure.
And we've had the gardening couple, Gary and Jesusa Heilig.
And
here.
We are just plain having a hoot here.
Yes,
and
we should have been recording, as Tom said. It was pretty good, this conversation.
Yes, you missed some real dialogue here. And there's a dialogue of learning. Gardening is not a one-time science that you figure out. It's a continuous, but it's a love. It's going to be like what it's going to be in heaven.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to be learning forever in heaven, and we're going to enjoy every moment of it.
I always used to tell people that lawyers, doctors, dentists, all those guys are going to be out of business in heaven, but I'll just be moving into my own.
Oh, that's funny.
Amen.
Okay.
I like your thinking.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, I want to talk about tomato diseases. Do I really need to spray?
Well, yes. Now, there are some diseases that aren't what we call direct diseases that don't affect the fruit.
I thought they were all diseases.
No, what I mean by that is Septoria leaf spot, for instance, early blight. Those are two things that affect primarily the plant leaves. But you get some later diseases like anthracnose, which will actually affect the fruit. And that you definitely want to treat for. But when you have a leaf disease on tomatoes, it usually causes the leaves to drop. And of course, when you lose the leaves, you lose the factory that makes the sugars.
Ah, okay.
So it will affect the quality of the production in terms of the overall amount if you get defoliation too early in the season.
So you need to spray. So what kind of sprays?
Well, there are a number of different things. For people who want to do organic, or they have copper sulfate, for instance, a more common material for just conventional is chlorothalonil, or it's also called Daconil. And both of those will control just about all of those diseases.
And you get these at the garden
center? Any garden center or box hardware store will have them.
I was telling Tom earlier that one year we had 72 tomato plants.
So a lot of tomatoes.
Yeah, so I actually went out and bought a sprayer specifically for copper sulfate because I was spraying about every 3 days to keep the what's it called? The mold?
Well, Septoria leaf spot and early blight.
Yeah.
The major things.
Because it takes your tomato plants out. So, yeah, I was out there spraying. That was my kind of like my every other day exercise to go out and spray them. But the other thing is, too, that we have found that the closer we plant our tomato plants together, the more likely they have diseases. So each year we try to space them out about 3 feet apart. And that allows air to move all around the plant, keeps the leaves dry, and prevents some of the diseases that can happen with tomatoes.
So if somebody's, you know, they're not going to, like, harvest and, you know, can or anything, but they just want to have some fresh tomatoes. Well, so a container plant, a couple of container plants sitting around would be good then.
Yeah,
you can move them around.
You can grow anything in a container that you can grow in the ground, but you want to be sure that you have the right size container for the tomato. There are small tomatoes like cherry tomatoes that will be on what we call determinate bushes, which means they only grow so high and that's it. But if you were to put like big beef in a container, you better have a big container because that is what's called an indeterminate tomato, and it will continue to grow until it's frosted. So if you were to stretch the vine out over time, it would be about 8 to 10 feet high.
Wow.
Now, when we cage our tomatoes, my wife chops them off, which I really don't like. But but anyway.
We need to rebuttal after you get done with your statement.
Yeah.
Well, when the tomatoes start getting taller than me, I'd take the scissors to them.
Otherwise, you could put a cage on top of the cage, and you could have taller tomatoes if you wanted.
And that brings up a trellising. And, I have trellises, and last summer these indeterminates toppled over my tomatoes, and we couldn't keep them up. What can we do? I go to the garden stores, and I see things, trellises. Oh, they're beautiful trellises. I say, I'm not going to pay that. I'm not going to get my return on my investment if I buy these trellises.
Mm-hmm. Well, commercial growers don't use all those trellises, but they get their tomatoes up off of the ground because when they're on the ground, they're more likely to get disease. Mm. They use something called a stake and weave system.
Stake and weave?
Stake and weave system. And what that is you have stakes about every 4 feet, and they're usually about inch square. And then they use a string that does not stretch. And what they do, as the tomatoes are growing, they will start the string on one side, and they'll go down the row on one side of one plant, then they'll go to the other side of the other plant, and then when they get to the next stake, they wrap it around. So they continue this process all the way to the end of the row, and as the tomatoes grow, they come back down the row again from the opposite direction, and then as they continue to get taller, they follow that process again. And so you go back and forth doing that weaving and attaching it to the stake, and that holds your tomatoes up off of the ground, just like if they had been in a cage.
As it grows vertically.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Does that
and
help?
So the expense is the wood.
It does help.
up front, and that wood can be used yearly, and then you just have to buy the string after that.
Now, do you have to wrap it around the plant, or it just kind of holds it kind of going back?
As you weave in and out, because when you go to the right side on one particular one, when you're going, say, north-south, when you come back from the south to the north, you're on the other side with the string, and you're doing that on both sides as that plant is growing
up. So you're containing it on either side.
Right. It's sort of like a little netting that holds the plant in place.
So you don't have to connect to the plant. You're just giving it something to lean against.
That's right. That's all you're doing.
It's like a string cage is what I'm thinking of.
Okay, mm-hmm. I like that.
Interesting.
That'll be in my garden this year.
Okay. All right. What about irrigating vegetables and fruits?
Well, one of the things that we've been doing, because I'm always analyzing how much time does everything take. And we deal with the weed problem by mulching everything. So then another thing that you have to do is spend time watering, and that can take quite a while. And our gardens are quite a distance from our well, so we have to have hose to go out to everything. So what I've done in the blueberries and what we do in the vegetable garden, we irrigate, and we use drip hoses in the garden. And I have a hard plastic irrigation system in the blueberries. And they have little headers on them. And I picked up all these parts from, I think it was Lowe's. And then on our deck, I have piping that goes all the way around the deck. And I have little headers that come off. And those are little drip tubes. And I have that on a timer. So the deck is on a timer where I don't even have to bother watering it. And I can adjust it based on what kind of irrigation head I put on it to give me so many gallons per minute, or I can have little risers that will spray it, or whatever I want to do. So I find that saves a lot of time in terms of watering, and I even have that on my bed behind the garage.
Now, last year, I set up two fan oscillating sprinklers like you mm-hmm. find on the lawn, and that's how I did it. So yours is more targeted than mine.
It is. It saves water, and that's more important if you're in the city where
you're metered.
Where it's metered. Mm-hmm. Out in the country, I can run my pump forever, and all I have to do is worry about burning out the pump, but it doesn't add a lot to my electric bill.
Well, Gary liked to use overhead watering, but I felt that he was watering the weeds also.
Okay.
So we went to the drip hose, and that works out so much better.
That's more targeted, what you mm-hmm. said.
Very mm-hmm. targeted. And while I'm in the garden, I actually run the hose from the water hose from drip hose to drip hose while I'm actually in the garden working.
You're not getting all wet.
And well, no, then it's not. I don't have to use extra time to go out there and work in the garden. While I'm there, I do the watering at the same time, and it's not getting you all wet because it's going right into the plants right where it needs it. So it's very efficient.
And what I want to do is bury a line out to the garden, and then we'll have what's called a header line, and then there will be a switch for each row, and she can just turn it on or
almost like a manifold.
Yeah.
And so you can get that from the farm supply stores too.
Mm-hmm. Now, overhead watering is okay, but it is true you do water everything, mm-hmm. and weeds love it.
And just to clarify, what I did was overhead watering.
Right. Okay. Yeah, and I have a tower that I just love to watch it go around.
Okay,
it's kind of therapy, but it does waste water more.
Isn't gardening therapy anyway?
Yes, it is. But also, if you're doing that in the evening and the plant leaves stay wet, then you're increasing your disease pressure.
Particularly in tomatoes.
Particularly in anything. Okay. So most of the diseases we have to deal with in gardens are fungal diseases, and they like moisture.
So what about controlling poison ivy?
Well,
I hope that's not in my garden.
A lot of times people wonder why poison ivy shows up in their garden.
Yeah.
But a poison ivy plant has a little white berry that the birds will eat. And what goes in a bird will eventually come out.
Okay.
So the seeds come out, they make it through the digestive system, and poison ivy can pop up anywhere in the yard.
So there you go. That's how they end up in the garden.
That's right.
I've never even seen it in my garden.
Now,
it'll get there eventually,
right? It could be anywhere.
You need a mother plant.
It could be around your trees, your shrubs. It could even end up on the fence in your garden. It just depends on if the birds, you know, do their business in your garden. So there's a product called triclopyr. It's also called Garlon. And that's very effective against poison ivy. There are no effective organic products because most of the organic products are burned down and you need something that's going to go to the roots. And for those people who don't mind using Roundup and are careful with it, Roundup will also kill poison ivy, mm-hmm. but it will take out other things too. So what I normally do if it's running up a tree or up a fence is I'll take some pruning shears, cut it off at the ground, mm-hmm. so everything above that's going to die. And then when it starts to sprout from the base, then I'll treat that base, and that takes care of your problem.
Does a dead poison ivy still have oils in it?
Yes, it does, and the last thing you want to do is burn it. It can cause lung damage.
So you bag it?
Yeah, bag it and send it to the landfill. And what I use, I'll use disposable rubber gloves. Now, I've been through poison ivy. Some people are much more sensitive mm-hmm. to it than others. This is just Gary speaking here. I have no scientific basis, but I eat a lot of cashews, and poison ivy is in the cashew family, and I wonder if that has some effect in not being susceptible to
desensitized
it.
Desensitized due to it.
But don't take that as science. Just interesting theory, though. Yeah, it's an interesting theory, but I've never gotten poison ivy.
Well,
but you can get it if you've never been exposed to it.
And I'm one of those sensitive people because I've actually gone to the doctor and
had
poison ivy. So I'm going to eat more cashews.
Yeah, try it and see what happens.
Yeah, it's an experiment, but it's a risky one.
Yeah. That's true.
Okay, well, let's talk about attracting butterflies and mm-hmm. hummingbirds. What should you have if you want to attract them?
Well, for hummingbirds, they're a little bit more specific. They like tubular flowers, usually in the reds, oranges, and yellows.
Now, when you're saying tubular, what kind of flowers?
Like a trumpet. When you think of the shape of the front of a
salvia,
trumpet.
Salvia.
Yeah, salvia would be an example.
Canterbury bells, hollyhocks.
Yeah, all those are really good things to attract them. So, and those colors are specifically, they like those colors. Mm-hmm. And you'll see them coming in the morning and in the evening. Sometimes during the day, but most of the time it's morning and evening that they're there. Butterflies like just about any kind of flowering plant
Zinnias.
Because they're after the nectar.
Mm-hmm. What about the marigolds?
Marigolds are okay. I wouldn't call it a big attractant for butterflies, but especially the ones that don't smell very well, but but they will attract some butterflies.
Do any of them smell well?
Oh, yeah. There are a number of flowers that smell really nice.
I mean, talking about marigolds.
Oh, yeah. There's some that have a really bad smell and others that are kind of
tolerable.
Not much of a smell at all.
Well, the year that we planted zinnias, a lot of them in the garden, it was the first year I saw my first swallowtail butterfly.
All right.
I had never seen one before in that year. And they came back and came back. So there must have been, you know, a lot of them around there. So my daughter had a chance to see them live because you see them in books and stuff. But we had a chance to actually see them live that year that we planted all the zinnias.
And Michigan State has a book on butterflies of Michigan. Oh. And they tell you the territory where you can find them in Michigan and the things that they like.
So let me ask you then. Okay, so you've got your garden, your vegetable garden. Do mm-hmm. you plant some of these flowers then?
We plant flowers around the edges of the vegetable garden mm-hmm. so that we can attract the butterflies. And it's kind of nice when you're out there working hard on a warm day and then all of a sudden a butterfly comes fluttering by. And you just take a minute to enjoy the nature. It's really cool.
And what if you have a little waffle of the breeze bringing a fragrant plant smell to you? It just adds to the experience. I'm just wondering, you mentioned about planting these. Last year, I bought the marigolds that for deterrent, but I bought them in already pre-planted. Mm-hmm. Can I do it from seeds?
Marigolds are very easy to grow from seeds, yes.
How soon do I do it indoors and replant it, or do I do it direct seed, but I got to do it early now?
If you want them to flower sooner, then you should start them inside. I would start them now.
Which is, we're in April recording this.
I would start them now. Well, yeah, and well, it's April now, but it would be too late in June or July or whatever, so you'd have to buy them then. But I would normally start my my plants, if I was growing marigolds, probably late March, early April.
So now in June, is it too late, though, to do gardening in a container?
No, you can start a garden in a container all the time. What I did one year is I didn't start a tomato until about July, and then I took it in the house and had it under lights, and I had fresh tomatoes until December.
Yeah.
Now, so I have a greenhouse now, and so I could probably have them not much longer.
But you planted your tomato in July. You started it.
I put my transplant in at that time.
In July.
Yeah, in July. Okay. And then, of course, what happened is it was starting to produce at the time just before we were starting to get a frost, and then I moved that plant inside down into the basement, and I continued to collect tomatoes from it till December. Yeah.
And I'm a sale lady, so I go to Home Depot and haunt the garden area. And when the things start being 50% off, especially their larger plants that they want to charge you like $12 and $15 for, it's hard to believe for a tomato plant, I'll get it for $7. I'll bring it home and plant it on the deck. And then we have our cherry tomatoes right on the deck, and it's a huge plant. So you can take advantage of that too late in the summer. So it's one of the things that works for us.
Anything you can grow on the ground, you can grow in a container. You just have to have the right size container for the plant.
And it doesn't matter if it's in the ground or in the container. You got to take care of it.
Yeah.
And water it.
Especially when you're using artificial soil mixes, they dry out faster. So you have to pay attention to water during the summer.
And we've got to throw something to the yard and the gardeners, the turf. Just 1 minute of turf advice for June.
Well, normally there's not a whole lot to do. You're past the time that you would treat for crabgrass. Broadleaf leaves or broadleaf weeds are pretty strong by then, so it's not very effective spraying
them
at the time.
So just sit back and enjoy, but you may need to do aerating?
Yeah, you could. Aeration is for lawns that have been compacted for some reason, a lot of traffic or something. It's a machine that actually takes plugs out and it helps water and air to get down to the roots, so that's done a lot in high traffic areas like parks.
Or golf courses,
those type of things. But during the summer, you're pretty much mowing, and we can talk about some more details about those things at a later date, but there's not a whole lot to do at that time.
Okay. Well, folks, you've been listening to Strong Tower Radio Today program, and it's good gardening with our gardening guy, but now it's the gardening couple.
That's right.
Gary Heilig and his wife, Jesusa. And Gary has a YouTube channel. So all you got to do is go on your internet and go to YouTube and look up Gary Heilig. And it's H-E-I-L-I-G. And he's got lots of videos there, and he's going to be adding more videos. We will keep you posted. So, Tom, you're looking forward to our next program?
I am.
All right, well, thank you for listening, folks. You have a great day. Bye.
Bye.